The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. So we are gathered here this evening to talk about baseball. And by that, I mean the thing itself. We are also here to talk about one of the greatest players of the sport who happened to grow up in North Philly. We have two authors to guide us around the bases. Our first speaker, Zach Hample, has turned his obsession into a vocation. He has snagged more than 4,600 baseballs from the stands at Major League Baseball stadiums, including our own, and he is the author of How to Snag Major League Baseballs and one of my favorite books, Watching Baseball Smarter. In fact, I don't watch a game without it by my side. His new book, The Baseball Stunts, Scandals, and Secrets Beneath the Stitches, tells you his exact topic for this evening. Our second speaker, historian Neil Langto, has written about the economics and history of baseball with a specific focus on the Negro Leagues. His previous books include Fair Dealing and Clean Playing, The Hilldale Club, and the Development of Black Professional Baseball, and Negro League Baseball, The Rise and Ruin of a Black Institution. Of his new book, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette writes, with the publication of Neil Langto's superb Campy, the baseball biography of the year, Roy Campanella's story has finally been told. So we'll start with Zach Hample, and then we'll move on to Neil. Zach, would you like to join us?
Well, hey, everybody. I had about 100 photos that I was going to flip through on my laptop and show you, photos of early baseballs with weird stitching patterns, photos from the Rawlings factory in Costa Rica that didn't even make it into the book. So let's make this interactive in a different way. I want to see a show of hands among people here. If you speak a foreign language, put your hands up. Yeah, we're looking for fluent speakers of foreign. Oh, all the hands went down. Okay, who speaks a foreign language, you know, reasonably well, or can get by a little bit, or knows a few phrases? What language do you speak?
Spanish.
Dame la pelota, por favor. Can you tell people what that means? It means I'll tell you. It means please throw me the ball. Other languages here. Other than Spanish, French, lancez-moi la balle, s'il vous plaît. Please throw me the ball. Do we have others? Yeah. Bitte, geben Sie mir einen Ball. Please throw me the ball. And how about you? Oh, you know what? We're going to have to speak afterwards. I need to learn that one. Anyway, I have learned how to ask for a baseball in more than 30 languages. One of the many tricks I've used to snag not 4,600 balls, because that's an old bio already. I've already snagged more than 600 balls this season at 76 major league games. So I'm over 5,200 baseballs now. And a great way to get baseballs tossed up is to ask the players for them. So keep that in mind. We'll get back to some baseball snagging strategies in a bit. I want to talk briefly about Charlie Sheen, because this is actually related. I'm telling you, this is not just a cheap thing here. This is serious. In 1996, Charlie Sheen purchased an entire left field pavilion at an Angels game, more than 2,600 seats. And the reason why he did that is because he was so determined to catch a home run ball that he wanted to eliminate all the competition. Okay? And unfortunately for Mr. Sheen, it didn't work. He had all of left field to himself, no baseballs hit out there. And I'm telling you all this, the languages, the thrown balls, Charlie Sheen, because nowadays we take for granted the fact that you can go to a game and catch a baseball. It's kind of like the all-American dream. You know, you're a little boy and you dream of catching a foul ball or better yet, a home run. But 100 years ago, when baseballs flew into the crowd, fans were not even allowed to keep them. And if you go back even further to the early days of baseball taking shape in this country, the early days of professional baseball, you can kind of understand why. If you go back to the 1840s, There were no factories or known manufacturers of baseballs. Those early baseballs were made just by anybody in the neighborhood who had some random materials and had enough skills to put them together. So people would start with any random hard object in the middle of a ball, like a rock or a walnut or even a bullet. Then they'd take some old string, maybe from an unraveled sock or an old fishing line, and they'd wrap it around the ball really tight. Then they'd cut up some old leather shoes into strips and take those strips and stitch them around that kind of mess that they wound up, and that was your baseball. Baseballs were very crude. They were lumpy. They'd hurt your hands. People didn't even wear baseball gloves back at the time. And it was such a big deal to simply own a baseball way back in the day that, first of all, there was only one ball that was used for an entire game. And the winning team would actually get to keep the ball. It was actually added into the official Major League rules in 1868 that the baseball would become the property of the winning team. And for a long time, if that one baseball went missing during a game, you know what would happen. The game would actually have to stop, and the players would go looking for it. In 1878, there was finally a rule adopted that said that there was a five-minute time limit for going to look for a missing ball. So this is sort of, the story of souvenir baseballs in this country just in the last century and beyond. 1916 was the first time that fans were allowed to keep baseballs because the owner of the Cubs at the time, a guy named Charles Wiegman, who I'm hesitant to call him a hero because he happened to be affiliated with the Ku Klux Klan, but as far as his views on baseballs, love the guy, he realized that the money that he would lose from fans keeping baseballs, he'd make up for it with more people buying tickets, hoping to get their hands on a ball and take it home with them. So that's really when things started to change, but he was the only guy who felt that way, and other owners, they just didn't agree. Do we have any Yankee fans here tonight? Sorry for what I'm about to say, but, Yankees have a long history, I guess, of being unfan-friendly because Cap Houston, a part owner of the Yankees, right around the time that Wiegman made his decision, he was just adamantly opposed to that. And he actually said, this is a direct quote, hopefully I'll get it right, he said, "Why should a man carry away an object worth $2.50 just because he gets his hands on it? When people go out to a restaurant, do they take the dishes and silverware home as souvenirs?" So that was the attitude of the Yankees back in the day. And even after fans were allowed to keep balls in Chicago, it took even a few decades before it was fully widely accepted throughout the major leagues that fans could keep balls. There were times even during the World Wars, as late as World War II, when fans would give baseballs back if they caught them because those would be donated to servicemen. So there was a time when it was considered unpatriotic to keep a foul ball way back in the day because it would delay the game. And then during the wars, it was also considered unpatriotic. But now, of course, people go nuts to get them. The book that I wrote, The Baseball, talks about this stuff. There's a lot about the souvenir craze. That's really how the book starts off. And I tried to write a book that kind of captured why baseballs are so cool, why they're historically and culturally significant. And it's sort of like a look at the sport of baseball through the lens of the ball itself. And there's a huge timeline in the book called The Evolution of the Ball, but it's really, in a way, sort of like an evolution of the sport. Again, if you go back to the late 1840s, baseballs were so primitive back then, and they were so flimsy, and they'd get hit out of shape, and you really couldn't hit them too far, that the outfielders had a tough time throwing the ball all the way back to the pitcher. And so they actually had to invent the shortstop for that reason, to get the balls back in. So it's interesting how you can trace the history of the sport, again, sort of through the baseball itself. One of the coolest things that I got to do in the process of writing this book was to visit the Rawlings Baseball Factory in Costa Rica. And it's not open to the public, and it's really not even open to the media. I was there last year, and before that, the previous media person who got to go was a Boston Globe reporter in 2003. It's so tightly secure. I was met by two Rawlings executives who had flown in from Missouri to give me a tour. They had to show their passports in the parking lot of the factory to get past security. And the reason why things are so tight down there is because Rawlings has an exclusive contract to be the provider of Major League Baseballs. They have unique winding machines in their factory that were developed by their own engineers, and they're paranoid that people will come in there with hidden cameras or even without cameras, just engineers will go and take a look at it and be able to duplicate their machinery. So it was quite an experience to be there. Baseballs are still, to this day, hand-stitched. If anybody can come up with a machine that would hand-stitch baseballs, you would be an instant multimillionaire. But it's too hard, basically, to start the stitching process and then to end it. I have a pretty cool video of that I filmed there, but won't be able to show that. But the baseballs themselves, though, are actually hand-stitched, wound by machines, but hand-stitched. There are 350 employees at the Rawlings factory who do nothing but stitch baseballs all day, 10-hour shifts. And they don't earn a lot of money by our standards in this country, but they do actually earn more than the minimum wage in Costa Rica. So there's a lot of allegations of sweatshop abuse and all this kind of stuff. I was down there. It's really not nearly as bad as people think, but it is a tough job, and it takes 14 minutes for an experienced baseball stitcher to complete one ball. And one of the very coolest things that I discovered about baseballs over the course of working on this book is that every baseball gets stamped with invisible ink at the factory. How many people here, show of hands, have ever caught a ball at a major league game? Even in batting practice. Go on, put your hands up. All right. Well, if you still have these baseballs, that's pretty good. That's a good percentage here. If you still have these baseballs and you know someone who has a black light or you feel like making a small investment, pick up a black light and turn off all of the other lights and shine that black light on the ball, there's a pretty good chance that you will see a little numerical code in invisible ink on the baseball. What that is, it's basically a quality control procedure. After every stitcher is done stitching a ball, it'll be collected by basically an inspector who roams the floor with a big barrel on wheels. And that inspector takes a very quick look at the ball, very quick, and if it looks okay, he will pick up a stamp on that employee's workstation. Every employee has a stamp with an individual number. And he'll dip it in invisible ink and stamp it on the ball, meaning it passed the first very brief inspection. He'll toss that ball in a barrel, and he'll collect a whole barrel full of balls, and then that gets wheeled into an inspection room where the balls are looked at much more closely. In that inspection room, there are two guys. They dump all the balls out on a little table with raised edges and a drop cloth, and they're looking for six specific correctable flaws. Now, obviously, if a ball gets scratched on the outside of the cowhide, you can't fix that. You know, sometimes a cow will bump into a barbed wire fence on a farm, and that will actually show up as an imperfection on the leather surface of the ball. So you can't fix that. But if a stitch is misaligned or if the two leather pieces aren't aligning properly, well, those things can be fixed. So if the inspectors in this room find something wrong with the ball, they'll pull it aside, send it to another guy who looks at it under a black light. That guy then sees the number appear in invisible ink, and he'll make a note of it on a Post-it note, stick that Post-it note on the ball, send it back into the stitching room to the employee who made it and say, here, fix this. So it's pretty impressive the amount of precision that goes into the baseballs there. The whole juiced ball theory, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of that. You know, when I first started researching this book, I knew about, you know, 1987, the juiced balls. Wade Boggs hit 24 homers that year. McGuire hit 49. Larry Sheets, if anyone even remembers him, hit 31. And I knew that there was some juice ball talk in 1961 with Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle. I didn't realize that the juice ball controversy actually goes back to the 1860s. In 1867, there was a team called the Nationals of Washington. And I should just interrupt myself for a second to say that at that time, the home team was actually responsible for providing the ball. So if the home team had a lot of powerful hitters, they'd provide a ball that was much more lively, that would help their own offense. Or if a team, you know, if they were sort of a so-called no-hit, all-fielding team, well, they'd provide a very dead ball. Well, the Washington Nationals had a very powerful team, and they used a really hopped-up ball that people complained about helping their own offense. So Pretty cool. Juiced balls all the way back to 1867. A lot of other fun stuff in the book that I tried to do. There's a whole chapter called Foul Balls in Pop Culture, where I critiqued a bunch of scenes from television shows and movies that have foul balls in them. Probably a lot of you guys know about the scene in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. That's one of the more famous foul ball scenes. There was also a really quick one in the movie Big. And there were a lot of shows with foul balls in them. Seinfeld, Sex and the City, The Simpsons did one. Even Sesame Street did a whole foul ball scene with puppets. And a lot of funny stuff. It just goes to show that the baseball itself is such an important item. And it's actually changed more than any other piece of equipment in the history of baseball. The final part of the book, I just want to check in on time, is called How to Snag Major League Baseballs. And it's kind of my way of bringing back my first book with the same title. I kind of redid it and crammed it all into a third of the new book. And the idea of the book is sort of like, well, here are two parts that show you how awesome baseballs are and all this fun stuff. And now that you know that, now that you just look at baseballs in a new way, now I'm going to show you how to go out and actually catch one for yourself at a major league game. So that was the idea behind the third part. And before I say anything else, I just want to give you a little demonstration. I showed you the whole language thing. I want to show you a trick that I have with my baseball glove. So just to set this up, there are times at major league games during batting practice when I'll be up in the seats high up above the field, 10 feet, 20 feet. There might be a gap between the outfield wall and the stands, maybe where there's a scoreboard, a manual scoreboard, or the groundskeepers keep some tools, whatever, a place where baseballs can be, you know, fly over the fences, home runs, but still fall short of the stands. And when those baseballs are just sitting below me, you know, when I was a little kid, I was drooling over these baseballs, trying to figure a way to snag them. So here's what I came up with. I call it the glove trick. Of course, I have string inside the palm of my glove and a rubber band that I stretch over the tip. And now watch this. So that's the glove trick. I don't catch all of my baseballs by using gimmicks like this and asking in foreign languages. Just a couple days ago, July 24th, the Sunday game in Baltimore, a couple people were already talking about this to me out in the lobby. And this is actually still, to this point, the very last ball that I caught. Mike Trout is an outfielder on the Angels, 19 years old, widely regarded as the number one prospect in all of baseball. And the Angels called him up a couple weeks ago. And I knew going into this weekend series in Baltimore against the Angels that Trout had not hit a major league home run. So on Sunday, when it was, they say, 99 degrees at game time, although it felt like about 199, so no one was really sitting out in the direct sunlight in left field, I took a look at those seats and I thought, oh yeah, baby. There was a lot of room to run, and so I was thinking about Mike Trout and how awesome it would be if he hit a home run and how little competition there would be. And in the eighth inning, he did hit a home run, and I caught it. It was, you know, I'm kind of annoyed because the TV cameras, they zoomed in on Mike Trout. They showed him celebrating with his teammates. They showed his parents in the crowd. You know, they showed the pitcher looking all sad after he gave up the home run. They didn't show me, you know. They didn't show my incredibly athletic play in the stands. I had to jump up out of my chair, run about 20 feet through an empty row. And I didn't even realize that I did this at the time. I didn't know that I did this until I saw the replay later that night on MLB.com. But I remember at the time when I was running for the ball thinking, uh-oh, this one's going over my head by a few feet. And I didn't think I'd be able to reach it. What I realized when I watched the replay later on, I actually, in the process of running, I took my eye off the ball, climbed back over a row of seats, then kept running, looked back up for the ball, and then made a jumping, lunging catch for it. So, you know, no love from the TV cameras. So the best I can do is brag about it to you guys, and I'll blog about it later. But really, the thing for me that I love so much about catching baseballs is just the way it makes me feel connected to the sport. You know, it started off as just a childhood dream and then turned into a dorky hobby from there. And now look what it's turned into. I guess it's a dorky adult hobby. But I went to my first game when I was 6, and I didn't catch a ball. I went with my dad. It was bat day at Yankee Stadium in 1984. And we aimed to arrive right around the first inning. And, of course, we got lost and hit traffic and arrived in the third inning. We then proceeded right up to our upper deck seats. I was packed in the middle of a very crowded row, and I was well beyond foul ball range anyway. Of course, I was still standing on my chair yelling, hit it here, and probably annoying everybody around me. And I went home empty-handed that day. Of course, we left in the eighth inning to beat traffic. And for 6 years after that, I never came close to getting a ball. But when I was 12, I found out about batting practice, which is really the number one way to catch a baseball. Show up early, the players are warming up, the stands are much emptier, security is much less strict. You can usually go anywhere you want in the stadium. And I caught my first ball when I was 12 at batting practice, and it was such a thrill. My dad described that moment years later as a baby shark tasting blood for the first time. And, you know, when you're young and you experience something great, you just want to do it over and over and over. And I think I have an obsessive personality by nature. So there was no place that I wanted to be more than at a major league stadium, and I often still feel that way. And I just do feel a great connection to the game. Obviously, catching a big-time prospect's first home run was great. Security asked me what I wanted for the ball. I just said, listen, I just want to give it back to him myself and shake his hand. And his mom, his parents were there at the game. They came out and found me in left field, so I got to meet them. She asked what I wanted for it. I said, well, you know, I've never gotten a jersey before. I don't know if that's too much to ask, but, you know, if he has an extra one, that would be cool. I told her I don't need another baseball bat. I've gotten a bunch of those. I've gotten a bunch of balls. But ultimately, I didn't get a jersey. That was fine. You know, I was just happy to just catch the ball and be part of this moment. You know, I've never played fantasy baseball in the traditional sense, but for me, going to games and running around and thinking like a manager and positioning myself differently for lefties and righties and a slap hitter and a power hitter, you know, that's my version of fantasy baseball. And in writing this book, I just really wanted to kind of share that passion with people, teach them how they can go to games too and experience some of the joy of really being connected a little bit closer to the sport than most people can. And really just to show how awesome baseballs are. You know, it's almost like a way of saying, like, look, okay, I'm obsessed, I'm kind of weird, but look, the baseballs are really cool, okay? Like, this is why I like them so much. So that was kind of the idea behind the book, and learned a ton writing it. It's just been great going to games and meeting people who show up with their copies and signing copies for kids and just making the rounds and really feeling more connected than ever to my favorite sport. So thanks for having me here. Glad to share some of this stuff with you guys. Are we doing questions now? No questions now. Well, that's an easy question. How old am I? Should we make her guess or should I just... I'm 33. So, in any case, thank you all for listening to me talk about baseball. My friends are so annoyed by now. Whenever I start, they're like, oh, here goes Zach again talking about baseball. So it's fun to go somewhere where people actually want to hear about it. So thank you all again.
I'm not sure how I can get a segue from baseballs to Roy Campanella, but I'll try. Campy actually, you know, he's from Philly, and he grew up in Nicetown, fairly poor, and he tells a story of when he was a kid, they didn't have any baseballs. They had what they called a nickel rocket. Anyone ever heard of a nickel rocket? Those were the real cheap baseballs, and he tells a story when he was a kid, they would use a nickel rocket, and it would get bent out of shape. And what they would do, they'd wrap it with electrical tape, and they'd use the same ball for day after day after day. And that's the kind of baseball that can't be used, which I think wasn't very atypical growing up in Philly in the 1930s. Typical kid probably had one ball to play around with. Anyway, that's my attempt at a segue from Zach's discussion of baseball to Roy Campanella. Those of you who have seen my book, you might have seen when you came in, notice it's a fairly long book. And you might wonder, how did he come to write such a long book in the first place? And that's really what I'm going to talk about. I've got 20 minutes here, and I'll just talk about the process of how I wrote this book about Roy Campanella. And if I have a little time, I'll get more into some of the highlights of his career. But for tonight, I'll get into the process of the writing. The book was an outgrowth of a few things. One of them was my last book, which, as Andy mentioned, was about the Negro Leagues. So I'd written about the Negro Leagues before and about baseball history. I've always had a love of history, and I've always had a love of baseball. So it was natural I would try to find some kind of subject, again, in that area. But really what pushed me to do this book was a suggestion from the late Jules Tigel, who was sort of the foremost scholar on Jackie Robinson. And he just mentioned to me one time, he said, you know, there hasn't been a book on Roy Campanella in years. I said, okay, well. And I knew the basics about Roy Campanella's life, and I wasn't necessarily sold on doing a book on him. And what I decided to do was simply kind of just do some preliminary groundwork to see, well, what's in this guy's life, and is there enough here for a book that the public might be interested in? So I started digging into Campy's life, just looking into seeing whether I wanted to do a book on this guy, and I started to see how interesting a figure he was. One of the most remarkable things about Campy's story is that he grew up biracial in Philadelphia in the 1920s. His father was Italian-American. I think his people were from Sicily. And his mother was African-American. Now, of course, today we have a biracial president. But in the 1920s, that was a pretty rare thing. And it was a pretty rare thing in Philadelphia. I mean, it was absolutely exceptional to have that kind of relationship. And one of the disappointments in writing this book, I was never quite able to find out how this pair came together in Nicetown, how this African-American woman and Italian man got together and got married. But that was something I found very fascinating from the beginning. Campy, however, didn't have any great, as far as identification, difficulties. In those days, if you had a drop of black blood, you were considered to be African-American. So Campy pretty much self-identified as African-American his entire life. Although he grew up and the kids called him names, they called him half-breed and things like that. But he was pretty much, that's the way society labeled him. So I thought that was an interesting part of this man's story, should I decide to do his book. Another thing I found very interesting as I started to do the research into just his background was that this guy started playing professional baseball at the age of 15, which is really a remarkable thing. You can find very few people, white or black, who started playing baseball at that age. When Campy was 15, he was picked up out of the Philadelphia sandlots by the Negro Leagues and began playing professionally and played there for the next 20 years, from 1937 until 1957. Campy also, as part of His story, was also among the first to integrate the major leagues. He joined the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1946. He joined their organization right after Jackie Robinson. So he is among the first group to integrate the major leagues. So that's another thing I thought, okay, that's another part of his story which could be very interesting. And, of course, he was part of those Brooklyn Dodgers, who are probably still the best-known and best-loved team in baseball history. Roger Kahn, with the Boys of Summer, immortalized the Brooklyn Dodgers of the 50s. And everyone knows the Brooklyn Dodgers, and Campy was a very big part of that. And, of course, what was also important about those Brooklyn Dodgers was that they were the first great integrated team. So that's another part of his story I thought would be appealing. He was also an enormously popular player in his time, far more than people realize today, simply because he's been gone for about 20 years. But Campy was so popular in the 50s. He was on national TV. He was popular among white people, black people. And there were years when he polled more votes in the All-Star game than Mantle or Williams. Just give you a sense of how big a figure he actually was in the 1950s. And he was also someone who was not boring, which I think is important. Sometimes you do a sports biography, and the guy's a great player in whatever sport, but they got no personality. Campy had a wonderful personality. He was very witty. He always had something to say. He just was a very colorful individual. So that's something else you're looking for as an author when you're going to write a book. And, of course, as I mentioned, he was a great player. He won 3 MVPs in his 10 major league seasons, which is, again, quite impressive, especially as a catcher. And he was an outstanding defensive catcher, had unbelievable throwing percentage. He was throwing out 60, 70% of the runners who ran against him in the 50s. Great hitter. Head and shoulders above everyone else in the 1950s. So I thought the raw material was there to do a book on this individual. What I also found appealing about this guy was that there was a story outside of baseball. I mean, baseball will in itself pull in a certain number of readers, but you want to also get people who are maybe just interested in history or American history or civil rights and things like that. And there was that side of Campy's life. Campy's stardom in the 1950s raised all kinds of issues as far as civil rights were concerned. As I said, he became huge. He became huge outside of baseball. He became a national celebrity. And this raised a whole issue as far as what kind of black celebrity are you going to be? Are you going to speak out, or are you going to kind of just keep silent? And this was a dilemma that a lot of black celebrities, not just in sports, but in the music world or in film or whatever, ran up against in the 50s. You know, should you be just grateful that you're in a position that you're in, or should you use what you've been given as a soapbox? Now, Jackie Robinson, his teammate, was a soapbox guy. He believed he had been given this opportunity and he should speak out. On the other hand, Jackie Robinson took an enormous amount of crap in the 1950s from the press and from much of America. Campy was very shrewd. He said, I'm staying out of this kind of stuff. I'm not going to say anything. But as a result, this became a really big issue between Campy and Jackie as far as what side you should take. And it actually broke apart their friendship. And if I have time, I'll get into that issue. But that's, again, a civil rights issue that was raised in Campy's story. And the last part of Campy's story, which I found very, very appealing and also felt had very good raw material for a book, was the story of Campy's accident, which left him a quadriplegic. At the height of his career, well, at the end of his career in 1957, Campy was in a tragic car accident, which, again, if I have time, I'll get into the specifics. I was able to uncover for the first time the truth of what occurred that night in that accident. But Campy was left a quadriplegic, and Campy was left a quadriplegic in the 50s at a time when treatment for quadriplegics was just getting off the ground, and he became very much a spokesperson as far as the disabled were concerned, kind of like Christopher Reeve has in our own time. In fact, today I was gratified to see that the Christopher Reeve Foundation, I think his wife as the name of it, had put my book on there as a book to recommend for people who with spinal cord injuries. So Campy is a very important figure in the disability realm as well. He's someone who will not hide his disability. He will be really the first celebrity in a wheelchair. You can say Franklin Roosevelt before him, but Roosevelt never appeared publicly or really tried to hide that he was in a wheelchair. So Campy's important in that realm. So there's a lot here, I thought, to do this book. And that's what nudged me to sort of pursue it more seriously. And, of course, commercial issues come into play, which Zach can attest to, too, when you do a book. You got to think of the public. Are people going to buy this? The main source for Campy's life was his autobiography, which had been written in 1959. So it's 50 years old. It's out of date. Writers for years had cribbed from this thing, and sports writers, everyone goes back to that autobiography. And there's been nothing new since then. There was a TV movie in the 70s. Maybe some of you might remember the TV movie. But that had been sort of the canon on Campanella for years. So with all this in mind, that the guy had a great story, a lot going on to his life, and commercially I thought the time was ripe, that's what pushed me to pursue this biography on Roy Campanella. Okay, so I make this decision. I'm going to write a book on Roy Campanella. How do you write a biography of someone? I'd never written a biography before, and that's something you kind of learn on the fly. How do you put together someone's life, particularly someone whose life was fairly well documented? I started with certain tools that I would be using, and one of them was that autobiography, which Campy had written in 1959. That was the canon. But I knew that autobiography was not particularly reliable, as most historians will tell you. Autobiographies are very self-serving. They leave in certain things that will obviously make their subject look better, and they'll leave out things that will make them look not quite so nice. So I started with the assumption that pretty much everything in Campy's autobiography was probably distorted at best and at worst not true. And I really was not disappointed as I went through his book and started to compare it to what I could find out. Campy was someone who really worked hard to shape his public image. He kind of saw himself as a Will Rogers in a baseball uniform. You know, he never met a man he didn't like. He loved baseball. He loved his family. He loved his mother, that kind of thing. But there was more to him than that. But he was a master at the spin, and he spun things a certain way, and he spun his autobiography a certain way. So that was something I had to be wary of in writing this book, to sort of try to get at the truth and sort of cut through some of Campy's BS. I did use the autobiography at times when I could find nothing else to use, but I tried to use it as sparingly as possible. As an author, you don't want to just replicate what's already out there anyway, so you want to bring new material to the table. My research technique, such as it was start at the beginning. In other words, start when Campy was born in 1921, and you try to find out what you can find out about his family, where did they live. I learned that Campy lived on 1538 Kerbaugh Street in Nicetown. The house is still standing today, believe it or not. I was able to look into the census and try to find out when his parents came over. When did his father come over from Italy? When did his father's people come over from Italy? When were his mother's people emancipated from slavery? So that's how you start. You just go from the beginning and start working your way forward. And then it becomes, when you're writing this kind of book, a process of gathering, just gathering more and more information. And you just try to find out what is out there and try to make heads or tails of it. And you try to read as much as you can. A lot of this material is written, as I said. You have newspaper stuff. Campy was someone who was in the newspapers as early as 1936. When he was a kid playing baseball in Philadelphia, there were stories on him in the Philadelphia Inquirer. There were stories in the Philadelphia Tribune. He was already making a name for himself. So they spelled his name wrong all the time, though. Campanello, whatever. They were always misspelling his name, which kind of went on for years. But he's someone who had a very rich documentation. You also have the option of using interviews, because Campy was born in 1921, so obviously there are people who knew him are still alive, so you want to reach out to them. This is a book, I wish I had started it 10 years ago. There were so many people who knew him who had passed away only recently, so it was a struggle. One of the problems I ran up against early in this book was whether to get family involvement in the book. Campy was married three times and had three sets of children. And if you can believe, there was a lot of quite a bit of dysfunctional nature in these marriages, in these relationships. I ran up against this, and I was trying to get the family on board in this process, to get them to agree to be interviewed. And it was a question I was really, I was not really sure how far I should go to get their involvement. In other words, how much do you sacrifice as a biography to get the permission of the family? And I went back and forth with the Campanellas for a while, trying to get them to sign off on this project. And eventually, after two or three years of this, they finally said, no, we won't do it. It was going to be a case where they would only do it if they could have veto power over what went into the book. And myself, as a writer and historian, did not want to make that compromise. So as it turned out, the family did not sign off on this book. And I think in some cases proved to be obstruct the book in some ways, which I'll get to in a second. I also ran into some problems trying to talk to some of Campy's old teammates. Now, Campy's old teammates are the old Brooklyn Dodgers. They've been interviewed about 10,000 times in the last 30 years. Some were more willing to talk than others. I ran into one of Campy's very close friends, who said, yeah, I'll talk. I charge $5,000 for a half an hour of my time. So I politely declined that particular request. I talked to another of Campy's old teammates, a very well-known pitcher for the Dodgers, who basically said, you're on your own. I've been lied to so many times by writers. He was quite bitter with his dealings with writers. So you run into that kind of thing, too. But there were also some very nice people who were extremely generous with their time, who talked to me extensively about Campy and shared their memories. Monty Irvin, who some of you might remember from the Giants in the 1950s, came out of the Negro Leagues also. He's 91, talked to me for 2 hours about Campanella in those days. And people like Carl Erskine, who pitched for the Dodgers, also were very, very gracious with their time. When you get these interviews, you have to also worry about their reliability, oral history. When you're talking to someone, you have to wonder, okay, do they have an agenda, number one? And old ball players are also kind of, you have to worry about them, because some of them tell some very good stories. They can spin a great story, but the story may have very little basis in fact, So that's sometimes, you run into that with the old-time players, particularly in guys who've been interviewed many, many times. And a lot of these Dodgers have been interviewed over and over the years. So to try to get something fresh out of them was not the easiest thing. You try if you can. But again, with ball players, sometimes their ball players' memories tend to fade, tend to be distorted. So you have to keep that in mind as well, and how much will be usable. I always tried to verify as much as I could, but sometimes that wasn't possible. But oral history was very, very important in writing this book, because it did uncover some things about Campanella I would never have known, certainly about his car accident that left him a quadriplegic. Campy, the story of his accident was basically he told the story years in the newspapers at the time, covered a certain way. They said Campy was driving home from his liquor store that night, and his car crashed. that it was snowing that night and the weather was bad, and Campy simply lost control of the car. He was driving a rental car. And I was not happy with that explanation. And as I did more and more research in the book, I started to find holes in the story. And then when I started talking to people, more holes started to emerge. And one of the holes was from Buzzy Bevesi, who was the general manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers for years, and later the Los Angeles Dodgers. And he was very close to Campy, very discreet. And Bevesi said to me, well, Campy was somewhere he shouldn't have been that night. And that was kind of the first, oh, what does that mean? And then I talked to Roy Campanella's second wife's good friend, Ruth Bowen. Ruth Bowen was actually a booking agent. She was Dinah Washington's booking agent, remarkable woman. And she said he was with another woman that night. And then you talk to more and more people. The whole story unfolded that Campy was basically, it was not as he told it. He was driving home that night, stopped two places. One was at a jazz club. The other was at the home of his paramour. And then he drove home that night and then fell asleep at the wheel. And again, all of this would never have been uncovered without oral history, because the newspapers at the time simply did not get into the salacious stuff. You know, in the 50s, politicians were protected, athletes were protected, and they just didn't get into that stuff. So that's, you know, that's, again, the point of the interviews can be very, very important in bringing this kind of stuff up. After 2 years of the research of the gathering and the interviews and the pages and pages of notes, then you have to try to write something. That's not so fun when you're facing thousands of pages of notes and trying to make heads or tails of them. That's why my book is 400 pages long. You have to wonder, what kind of book are you going to write? Are you going to write, what kind of structure you're going to use? And I wasn't that creative. I just said, I'm going to do straight cradle to grave. He's born the first page and he dies on the last page. And that was the way I did it, and that worked for me. Some people do flashbacks and things like that, but I guess I'm not that creative with that. So I knew I had to write for a more general audience. The other books I had done were more academic. So this book was for Simon Schuster, which is a more general publisher. So you try to obviously write for the general public, and hopefully I've succeeded. I knew I wanted to get into baseball a lot, but I also knew I wanted to get into those issues I touched on earlier, the civil rights issues, that I wanted that to be an important part of the book, Campy's handling of civil rights and how he evolves and how he's a sort of say-nothing in the 50s, and then by the 60s he's much more outspoken, and how you see this in his relationship with Jackie Robinson. This is a very important part of the book. The disability issues also, I wanted to get into that too, how Campy's treatment was revolutionary in the 1950s, and how he handled his disability was also very, very important, and how he gave inspiration to people. So I thought that was also something significant to get into. And then there were family issues. You know, I wanted to get into his personal life. Again, sometimes people write sports biographies and they don't say a thing about the wives or the kids, and I think that's fair game. Not that I was trying to write a salacious book, I was not, but I think it is part of someone's life, and I think it's something you need to get into, particularly a man who had three marriages and several different children and had stormy relationships with them. So I felt that had to be introduced as well. So that's also something I wanted to be in the book. So I tried to tie these things together, the baseball story, the personal life, the civil rights issue, and the disability issue, and wrap them up into a big bow. And that's why I ended up with this gargantuan 400-page book. But hopefully, as I said, I've managed to accomplish something here, make it a book that is a contribution to not just baseball history, but to civil rights history and to disability history. How am I doing with time? Good? Are we good, Andy, or? Okay. We staying up here, or?
Grab some glass of water if you want.
Yes, I do.
Right, so the trick is trying to knit this together, and I'm hoping your questions are going to help out with that. Lady in the red.
Sorry. I have a question for each of you. First, could you comment on the fact that people are literally, for lack of a better word, dying doing what you're doing, catching the foul balls, and they are. And my other question for you is, could you talk a little bit, did you read a lot of sports writers growing up? I mean, what kind of sparked this this interest? I mean, I'm not athletic, but I do enjoy reading about sports, so I'm curious if you also had that experience growing up.
Is this thing on?
Good.
I have a whole chapter in the book called Death by Baseball, and there were a lot of things that I wish that I had more time to talk about, and I suppose that's one of them. I think that people are accident prone and the world is a dangerous place, and you can die doing any number of things, but people still do them. You just have to be careful, and sometimes you get unlucky. And the gentleman who died tragically in Texas a few weeks back, leaning over a railing for a toss-up from outfielder Josh Hamilton, flipped over, landed on his head 15 feet down and died. I mean, that's just the worst thing. The Texas Rangers have since raised their railings way above code to 42 inches high at the expense of the view of seats in the first few rows. I don't know if that's the right thing to do or not. You know, that ballpark has been around for a couple decades, and there have been a couple of falls that fans have suffered in the last year or two. But there are hazards everywhere, and you just need to be careful. I've certainly had my share of accidents over the years at games. The worst was, you know, nothing life-threatening, but during batting practice in Anaheim a few years back, I was standing sideways in between a couple rows of seats, and home run landed behind me, ricocheted up in the air, and I was reaching out, caught the ball, lost my balance, plunged into the row below, landed on a metal armrest on my side, and cracked a rib. I broke my nose once when a fan jumped up and deflected a ball right into my face. Sprained my ankle pretty badly 2 months ago and was on crutches for a few weeks, just running around Citi Field. So these things happen, but I've never put myself in a position of possibly dying, I don't think. I suppose I could have hit my head when I've fallen over, but people just need to be careful. And I don't know, people just really want baseballs, you know, and we are willing to get hurt sometimes. And I think it's the people who've never caught a ball before, who have no experience in the stands and aren't used to leaning over railings. I think those are the people who are the most accident prone. I mean, I listed a few injuries that I've suffered, but that's in the course of more than 900 games attended in more than 20 years. So just watch out, people. Be a little bit more careful. Take it down a notch, you know?
Is this on?
Yes.
I guess your question was how I got interested in baseball, or did I read the sports writers when I was a kid? Or yeah, I mean, I grew up in New England, a Boston Red Sox fan, and I'm still a Red Sox fan. Sorry, Phillies fans. But anyway, I grew up as a kid, as a baseball loving kid, like Zach. It sounds like grew up collecting baseball cards and reading the sports pages, and this was pre-internet, of course. So, you know, we would read our little box scores and watch the news every night and things like that. So, and read all the baseball. I go to the library and get baseball books out. So, I mean, I think that interest for me was there as a kid. And then, as I said, I kind of fused it with a love of history as well. And that's how the two sort of manifested themselves.
Can I add one quick thing?
Sure.
Thank you. I don't know who I was actually asking, but in the history of Major League Baseball, does anyone want to guess how many fans have been killed as a direct result of being struck by foul balls in the history of Major League Baseball?
One.
Any other guesses?
One.
Was that nine or none?
None.
Anyone else? The answer is one. One fan in the history of Major League Baseball. It was a 14-year-old kid in 1970 at Dodger Stadium, a Manny Mota foul ball. I won't get into all the details now, but it's interesting that the baseball itself is less destructive than people's desire to catch one.
Another question. Right here. Got one, two.
My question, basically, Zach, seems to be a new tradition of throwing back a ball hit by a home run hit by an opposing player. What did you think of that?
How many baseballs are used in any one game, and what happens to the baseballs that are discarded?
Great questions, thanks. Throwing back opposing teams' home run balls, it's a tradition that started in Wrigley Field in the 1970s, the famous bleacher bums. There was one of them who was kind of like the ringleader out there. And one day, Hank Aaron hit a home run during a game. One of these guys caught the ball, and just on the spur of the moment, he thought it would kind of be a real, you know, won't do the gesture. We have TV cameras here. To the visiting team, and he actually threw that ball back on the field, and a tradition was born. I think it's great if people want to throw balls back. Personally, me, not going to happen. The first home run that I ever caught on the fly during a game was hit by an Oriole, Mike Bordick, at Yankee Stadium about a decade ago. And, of course, the whole stadium started chanting, throw it back, throw it back. And then those chants turned into something else. It was a seven-letter word. And if you've ever had 25,000 people chanting this word at you, it's not the most fun feeling, especially in New York. I had this really huge drunk guy get up in my face, scream and curse, and essentially his message was, throw the ball back on the field, you expletive deleted. And I just looked at him and I said, you catch a home run and you throw it back. And I turned back and faced the field, and I was ready to get a beer dumped on me, but he left me alone, and that was that. So that's how I feel about that. There have been some very historic home run balls thrown back on the field because fans, either they were stupid and didn't realize what was happening, or their team loyalty was, you know, more valuable than some money or the ball itself. Ivan Rodriguez's 300th home run ball of his career was thrown back on the field. The very first home run ever hit in the history of the Florida Marlins out in San Francisco was thrown back on the field. The ball that A-Rod hit to gain entry to the 40-40 club was also thrown back. So, I don't know. There's also a tradition where people will throw back a so-called dummy ball, where they'll keep the real one, and then they have a fake ball in their pocket, and they'll do a little switcheroo, throw back the fake one. And some of my friends do that. I know some guys in Baltimore. They actually write messages on the baseballs, the guys in Chicago. So on their fake ball, they'll write something like, don't throw that pitch again, and then they'll throw that ball. So then the visiting team retrieves it, and they see it. Or, you know, if you want your home run ball, come find me in section 340. You know, so you can be creative with it. The other question was, refresh my memory. Baseballs used in a game. The typical ball is in play for about six pitches. Over the course of a game, teams will usually go through about 100 balls. A lot of them are obviously fouled off into the crowd, tossed into the crowd by ball boys and ball girls. So those are gone. But the ones, let's say, that are thrown just short of home plate, just pitched and they hit the dirt and they get scuffed up and the ump tosses out of play, those balls will still get used. They don't get thrown in the garbage. They'll end up in the bullpen bag for pitchers to use. They might find their way back into batting practice. Even then, after they get beat up some more, they'll go down to the underground batting cages, and they'll get smacked around in the nets. And from there, even, they'll sometimes get sent down to the minor leagues. So a baseball will have a very long life as long as it stays within the possession of the team.
Gentleman in the Dodgers jersey.
I'm not a formal player for the Dodgers. I just look funny. I'd just like to disagree with you, Zach. My name is Zach, too, by the way. I think that
nice to meet you.
Pleasure. A line drive down the right or left field line into the stands, a rope, I think is extremely dangerous, and I would like to see the screen continue down those lines for fans' protection, but that's just how I feel. The other question I'd like to about Campy, one of my favorite books on the Dodgers is Bums, which is an oral history. And I zeroed in on what you said about the unreliability of that. And I just, if you could comment on Bums.
Yes, Bums is for those of you who don't know, is a very extensive book that was done by Peter Golenbach. He interviewed many of the former Brooklyn Dodgers. And it's a very nice source of Brooklyn Dodgers stories. However, it is filled with misinformation, and I would say it must be used with care. That's what I would say with most oral history. You know, you cross-check the facts, and sometimes the years are mixed up and things like that. And that book doesn't do that at all. It simply records what was said and doesn't try to attempt to tease out whether it's correct or not. So that's what I would say about it. And a lot of oral histories are like that, whether it's in the world of music or politics or whatever. If you don't have someone actually checking the facts, you just have to take it on face value.
Gentleman in the right in the middle there.
Thank you for asking. I've been giving away lots of baseballs to kids over the last number of years. When I was a kid myself, I kept everything, and now that I think I'm maybe at least 2% more mature, I think it's a nice thing to give back. So every game, typically, I'll give away maybe two or three balls on average. And of course, since I average about 8 balls a game, there are plenty of people out there who think I'm a selfish, greedy jerk, and, you know, how are you only giving away 2 or 3? To which I say, well, I'm still giving away more per day than most people catch in their lifetime. Also, since this is not something that I do really with the balls, as far as like where the balls end up, but it's connected to what I do with them. Since 2009, I've been raising money for charity by catching these balls. I've pretty much been getting people to pledge a little bit of money, anywhere from like a penny per ball up to $1 per ball, for every ball that I catch over the course of a season at Major League Games, batting practice included. And the money goes to a charity that's actually based here in Pennsylvania called Pitch In for Baseball. And that charity provides softball and baseball equipment to underprivileged kids all over the world. So the charity itself, they prefer to actually give brand new baseballs to the kids, and most of the balls that I catch are grass stained and beat up a little bit, so they actually wouldn't really want the balls that I catch, so that works out well. I get to keep a bunch, and I get to give away a lot to kids at games. But I've raised about $16,000 for the charity since 2009, and you know, really just by running around like a madman at these games. So it's pretty cool to get to do that.
Before we go to another question, Neil, I wonder if you could tell us, in your research on Campanella, was there anything that marked him particularly as a Philadelphian?
That's interesting. You know, he left Philly when he was about 15, so his connection to the city, I suppose, were kind of minimal. One thing I will say is that Campy almost ended up a Philly. He had a chance to play here in 1942 during the war there was some talk of integrating the major leagues, and the commissioner of baseball, Commissioner Landis, had said there's no rule against signing a black player. And so Campy went up to Shibe Park and went to talk to the Phillies owner, Jerry Nugent, and said, listen, Commissioner Landis says that blacks can play. Why don't you guys sign me up? At this point, he was already an established player in the Negro Leagues. And the Phillies owner, Jerry Nugent, if you know anything about Jerry Nugent, he was a horrible businessman. The Phillies were going bankrupt. They were drawing about 1,000 fans a game, and they were in last place for about the 10th year in a row. They had everything to gain by signing Campy, and instead they said, no, we just can't. You know, you'd have to play in the minor league somewhere. And Campy walked away and said, fine. And, of course, he ended up with the Dodgers and had a very successful career. And meanwhile, the Phillies stayed in the cellar for about the next 10 years. So that's Campy's big Philadelphia connection. So he always found that amusing when he came back to Philadelphia, because his dad was a Phillies fan and always kind of talked about them, and Campy would always tease him about that.
And just to show you where my mind is, when you mentioned 1,000 fans per game, I'm thinking, man, it must have been great to catch foul balls there. No competition.
Well, also the fact that
sickness,
he left
I admit
at
it.
15 marks him as a Philadelphian. A couple more questions here. Lady in the white, if you would just wait for the mic, please.
I've heard that the balls are rubbed with a special dirt from clay from a river in Delaware. Can you tell me more about that?
Absolutely. A Major League Baseball is very white and very shiny and brand new when it's taken out of the box. It's covered with cowhide, but that hide is bleached in many chemicals, and it's a long process that I got into briefly in the book. But the point is, those baseballs reflect the light, either the sun or the stadium lights, and they're also very slick to the touch. So it's hard for pitchers to grip a brand new ball, and it would be hard along those lines for batters to see them because of the reflection and the glare. So every game-used baseball, not just in the major leagues, but throughout the minor leagues and even in most colleges and high schools, but it started in the majors, when they're taken right out of the box brand new, the first thing that happens to them is that they get rubbed up with a special kind of mud to improve the grip and reduce the glare. And this mud comes from a very secret location located off the Delaware River, off a tributary in southern New Jersey, and it's called Lena Blackburn's Rubbing Mud. There was a former player and coach in the mid-20th century who basically was the first one to discover the best mud as far as rubbing the ball that would give it the right consistency. It wouldn't scratch it up too much. And it's a very intricate process for how these baseballs get rubbed up. And one of the cool things that I got to do in the course of researching the book, I called up a bunch of equipment managers for various teams, and one of them was nice enough to invite me down to a stadium when the team was away and give me a personal tutorial on how to rub up baseballs, and that was right here in Philadelphia. Dan O'Rourke, the equipment manager of the Phillies, was really cool. I spent an afternoon with him, and I got to rub up some balls that were then used in the game. I'm not sure if it was later that week or whenever, but we rubbed up a bunch, and every major league team receives 2 32-ounce containers of this mud, and that lasts the entire season for thousands and thousands of balls. And I actually broke down the numbers in the book and did some math where if you divide the ounces by the number of balls, it's such a minuscule amount of mud per ball. I think what it came out to is if you can imagine a penny cut into 10 pieces, if you were to take one of those pieces, that's about how much mud gets rubbed on the ball. It's just a very thin layer that just darkens it slightly and helps with the grip.
That sounds like it could be a new team stat, MPB. And you could see how much each team put on. Let's end with one more question, and I'd like it to be for Neil. Yes, lady in the middle, we'll get you a mic. The lady, could you keep your hand up, please?
Campy had, I think, 6 children from 3 different marriages, and he's actually, one of his children lives in South Jersey. She lives in Willingboro to this day. She's the one who, unfortunately, was cut out. He disowned her, which I get into in the book. I tried to talk to her. I did talk to his granddaughter, and she had some choice things to say about her grandfather who had cut her out. But I did try to talk to the elder children, the children from the second and third marriages, and as I mentioned, they would not speak to me unless they had veto power over what went into the book. So it became a choice. I had a choice I had to make, and I chose not to do that. I felt that was a concession that would hamstring me in writing this book. So,
well, unfortunately, we are out of time. Please join me in thanking Neil Langtell and Zach Campbell. Okay. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.